there is a global pattern of shared archaeology, shared advancement in stone building from what are primarily, when you speak to the indigenous cultures, lost civilizations. They're not attributed to that civilization. We do it. We attribute it to the Incas or the ancient Greece or Rome with the, you know, Temple of Jupiter. But the indigenous stories almost always will talk about lost civilizations. And a lot of the times they reference giants, man. Like, I don't know what to think about that. I really don't know. Like, I've been digging into it a bit.
Yeah, amazingly, I've hardly looked at my notes for this conversation, but giants is referenced in there. I was going to ask you on that, because that seems to be quite being brought more to the forefront now that there was giants.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the common conception is that Neanderthals were, for lack of a better phrase, incompetent. They were quite thick by comparison to how the intellect we as humans have got now, although that's debatable. But in actual fact, they might not have been. That's
definitely
sort of been a theory now.
Yeah, definitely weren't. I mean, like the prehistoric, like this is the, really, this is what fascinates me, prehistory. Like the things that we just say, oh, that's prehistoric, Neolithic, Stone Age, Stonehenge in our own country. I mean, that in of itself is an incredible multi-ton geometric stone building, astronomically aligned project that also incorporates this harmonic engineering. And I'm sorry, like Neolithic hunter gatherers that were barely even wrapping a stick around a stone to make like a basic hammer, they were able to do this. It doesn't make sense. Like, that's what I mean by it is insulting, because once you scrutinize it and like correlate what you're seeing with these structures and what the model tells you was going on in human history at that time, it makes zero sense. And Göbekli Tepe is such a good example of that, because prior to discovering Göbekli Tepe, it was just assumed to be a region of hunter-gatherers. Like, this is a hunter-gatherer area, and there's no evidence of advanced civilization. Suddenly Göbekli Tepe pops up, and the mainstream tries to push forward the idea that this must have been then created by the hunter-gatherers. It's like, that doesn't make sense. How did they get out of their deer hide tents and, you know, just suddenly one day erect one of the most incredible megalithic sites, again with alignments, again with solstice and equinox? They had knowledge of the sun, knowledge of the stars, knowledge of acoustics, knowledge of mathematics, knowledge of incredibly hard stone engineering. We're talking granite and diorite and andesite, things that are really high up on the hardness level, you know. So they were able to somehow, without any, and at this point with Neolithic, we're not even talking bronze and copper, we're talking, they haven't got any of that, they haven't got literally any of that, and somehow they created things like Stonehenge and these other areas. Newgrange in Ireland is another fascinating one. It looks like a huge dome from the top, incredibly sophisticated architecture that mimics, whether that mimics this or this mimics that, can't tell which one came first. But when I went to Malta, so many of the stone building projects there just look like Newgrange in Ireland. It's just like, huh. So why are there these global similarities and this pattern? And the Neolithic Stone Age, I think it was the Stone Age, but it was the age of stone in a different way to what we're saying. They were using stone as a technology. They were using energetic stones in, you know, specific alignments and geometries to do something that I think now, because we're so disconnected from the natural harmonies of the planet, the energies of the planet, and people can roll their eyes at that, but at the same time, the planet it's got a gigantic dynamo in the middle of it, and it produces a toroidal electromagnetic field. Like, we can talk about this through science, but you can talk about it through spirit and the energy and the cohesion of the planet and the harmony of the planet. And it feels like whatever this culture or global civilization was that was creating these stone building projects, they were in harmony with the planet. Like, a lot of these sites, like the henges and dolmens, which are like those like three stones with a large stone put on top of it, which are very contradictory. Like, how do they get these massive stones balancing on top of these three smaller stones? A lot of them are aligned to natural fissure lines in the planet. So that's also something that the New Age spiritual world would call ley lines. But there is a demonstrable science to it of fissure lines going through the planet where electromagnetism is focused. So it is a stronger current of electromagnetism going through these particular areas. And what do you find? You find henges and you find dolmens that are made out of materials that get influenced by electromagnetism, high quartz content rock and things like that. You find them all over the place connected like a network of nodes. And when you find parallels from different countries where the Giza Plateau lines up with somewhere in Peru across the same lines and somewhere like Stonehenge, it suggests a lost civilization that was using the natural materials of the planet like a technology. They didn't use wires. They didn't have cables. They didn't have superconductors and microchips. They were using natural flows of energy, natural focal like nexus points of energy, and using natural materials, creating natural geometries it was all very holistic, but high tech in a way.
Do you think that was perhaps a communication tool? Or
maybe,
like, you're always hearing kind of myths that someone travelled from the mountains, from the oceans, and passed this knowledge on. It could be that someone had the knowledge of building and I can't think of the turn of phrase, sorry, but basically had an understanding of how to build these ancient landmarks, and when travelled to other pockets of civilization and pass that knowledge on. Or do you think it was just a case of it was in sync with how you've just described?
Well, no, I think it's indicative of a globally influential culture that was able to go around the world and influence cultures to do these types of building projects. I mean, you know, you can invoke things like the bow or the ladder or a dagger as things that would be intuitively invented, most likely across cultures without contact, okay, because it's something that's so useful and so fundamental. The bow is a good example. It just seemed to be invented everywhere at once. So that's got nothing to do with cross-cultural pollination. That's, I don't know, what do you want to call that? The morphogenetic field of collective consciousness and, you know, whatever you might think that to be. But this, you know, you're talking about multiple different scientific disciplines being involved in this, right? So you've got the architecture and the mathematics and the astronomy and the acoustics. That can't happen like sporadically, randomly. Mm-hmm. That has to have been a core knowledge that was being passed on and shared. And like you said, there's all of these cases of civilizer gods, Quetzalcoatl, Oannes, or the Noah, you know, all these different archetypes of people that have come from a cataclysm and provided the survivors with knowledge. And I think that that's worth paying attention to. There's over 200 cultures that have a global flood myth, and we still disregard that. And it's interesting because, you know, if you saw the same kind of thematic sequencing in chemistry or biology or linguistics, you would call that a shared ancestry. But when it comes to mythology, we just say that they were making it up. Like, oh, it's just stories. But when every country and culture has a story of a global flood, a global deluge, and so many of them have stories of advanced beings or, you know, some individual arising from that with the knowledge of building a civilization again. Yeah, like, we should take that seriously, I think. It was so shocking when Ancient Apocalypse came out on Netflix and you just saw, like, Rolling Stones, New York Times, The Guardian. This is such a dangerous conspiracy theory, adult documentary. It's far right. A lot of, like, this is far right ideology. And a lot of that comes from the kind of like neo-Nazi beliefs of Atlantis. So a lot of the upper tier of the SS back in, you know, the Nazi German period were very interested in Atlantis and this idea that they came from a seed race. And so the like kind of far right neo-Nazis of today adopt that whole Atlantis mythology, which means that when you discuss it, people can then kind of claim that you're a racist or that you're trying to, you know, bring. And that's what happened with Graham Hancock. And it's just insane. I mean, he's a multicultural family, for the love of God. It's completely insane. But this is what happens. And they show their hand. They show their hand with how unbelievably biased they are when it comes to discussing alternative theories. And the only other thing I'll say with that is that saying that he was promoting kind of like racist and far-right ideologies when he's actually just listening to the indigenous stories, like, he's doing what the West didn't do. We go over, we make an assumption about the culture and we bring that back and we teach our children. He goes out there to Peru and sits down with the shamans and the Sufis and the different people, the holy people, listens to the oral traditions, and they say, well, you know, this place, Sacsayhuaman, came from a much older civilization than the Incas. But then Western historians will say it's the Incas. So it's just like this weird dynamic where he's actually paying attention to the cultural heritage, the cultural myth, the cultural story, the cultural folklore, and being branded a racist for that. Yeah. So yeah, it doesn't make any sense when you dissect it at all.
No, quite. There's a huge level of irony there.
Massive.
And it's, you know, it's like you said, I think I lose respect. So people, I don't really want to give him that too much airtime, but someone like a Flint Dibble who constantly shuts down Graham and you know, people who have this alternative view. They lose my respect to people like Flint Dibble, because why would you not want to be open-minded? I think it might have been yourself, because he went on Piers Morgan I'd love this to be true. And it's almost like that's a smokescreen for what you're about to say.
It's so
not,
yeah, exactly. Like, you can't say, I would love this to be true, but then go, oh, it's got all the hallmarks of pseudoscience and they've never tested it.
An incredible thing to claim has caused a massive response from both the alternative research community and the mainstream sectors.
I would love this kind of stuff to be true, but it is total bullshit. Using a method that has never been presented before in depth. It's never been tested. It follows all the rules of pseudoscience.
When they've tested it on the Gran Sasso laboratory in Italy, and they tested this technology on the Mosul Dam in Iraq, and Filippo Biondi, the guy that actually proposed this whole Doppler synthetic aperture radar fusion, has done it on structural integrity for bridges. Like, there's evidence of this proof of concept. So the thing with someone like Flynn Dibble is he loves to say, I would really love for all of this to be true. But then he does absolutely no research to see if it is true and then assumes it's not true. So that means that he's a debunker. He's got an agenda. He's got a bias. He's not objective. And I don't respect him at all. Christopher Dunn, who's an engineer who went out to Egypt, very famous for going out and finding so many of these machining tool marks that are just clearly evidence of something more advanced than copper tools and copper drills and sand abrasive, which is what they tend to say is used for these drilling holes. And they're just so clear and obvious. And so I think, you know, someone like Flynn Dibble, not to put too much on him, but, you know, there's a bias inherent in these people that just seems to strip away the imagination and the curiosity, which should be inherent in these fields. You know, you should be a curious seeker who's trying to find as much as you can. And what I find really frustrating about it is that there's an assumption that they're so methodical. There's an assumption that they've done so much work to, you know, conclusively say, well, the pyramid is this old, or this is when this happened, or the Inca civilization built this. But when you dissect it, there's actually just assumptions. It's just assumptions for the most part when it comes to attributing a specific time period to somebody's very contradictory sites. You've got the erosion in the Sphinx enclosure, which is just obvious. In fact, it was so obvious that when Dr. Robert Schock was standing inside one of the lines that has been caused by this degradation from water damage, the Egyptian government bricked up that particular area, which was just such an obvious chasm of where water had been pouring down. They literally put brick and mortar into it and filled it up. So it just, you know, it signifies, again, going back to what is the agenda here? There's an obvious desire to not let people entertain alternative theories about the age, about, you know, the origin, completely saturated with scientific principles, and pi is represented, the golden ratio, the fact that it sits on true north, the fact that you can actually get like the circumference of the earth from the parameters of the pyramids. There's so much encoded into the pyramid itself, pyramids themselves, that in of itself feels like something that needs to be reverse engineered and understood, and you get the knowledge of whoever was building it. You know, they've encoded their astronomy, their physics, their mathematics, their art, their acoustic sciences. That's another very interesting element of prehistory as well, is the acoustic engineering that's present in so many of these megalithic sites, whether it's Stonehenge in England, or Newgrange in Ireland, or the Hypogeum in Malta. Like, there's so many of these incredible sites that are tuned, specifically proven, tuned to types of harmonic ratios that actually interact with human consciousness. So that's another element that's also present in the pyramids. The King's Chamber is harmonically tuned to, I think, 110 hertz, which is the same range that's associated with meditative consciousness. And so, like, you know, there's all of these implications about the acoustics and harmonics. But yeah, like, the pyramids themselves seem to be scientific reverse engineering projects, where you find out more about the culture the more you understand how they built it. But in regards to underground, that could really be the true treasure, like the real knowledge, the real artifacts, the scrolls, the information from potentially a pre-cataclysm civilization. That's where I lean. I know that that's where Graham Hancock leans with a lot of this, maybe not particularly with the pyramids, but he's very open to the idea of a lost civilization. And their evidence for example, the Pyramid of Khufu, is that there was one scribbly little insignia on one brick. And was like, oh, there we go, it's Khufu's pyramid then. It's like, that's it. That's all you've got. You've got no body. You've got no mummy. You've got no similarities to the Valley of the Kings and the Valley of the Queens, where you've just got gold and calligraphy and hieroglyphics and motifs all lining every square inch of that space where these sacred burial chambers were for the kings and the queens and, like, the, you know, holy priests. And then you go into the pyramids, all of them, and they're just bare, completely bare, not a single hieroglyph. And so, you know, it runs in complete contradiction to the typical hallmarks of that culture, of that civilization, that they covered everything in hieroglyphs, which is just objectively true, because if you go to Egypt, you'll just see it on every single temple. but not on the pyramids, also not on, around the Sphinx temple, which some people believe is far older, potentially around the same age as the Sphinx, if the water erosion turns out to be true. Taking about, you know, 10,000 BC or plus. There's no hieroglyphs on those either. And they use a stone building technique that you then see echoed in Peru and other areas in Greece. And so, like, you know, that kind of signifies some form of a global pattern that, you know, this is far older and indicative of a global civilization. The lack of hieroglyphs, the lack of any mummies being recovered ever from the pyramids on the Giza Plateau, what is their argument? Again, once you start understanding just how much advanced science is present and architecture is present in the pyramids, there is far more evidence for the alternative theories of this being advanced, you know, energetic capacitor of some form, as contradictory and as strange as that sounds. You know, when you really get the fact that, for example, the core of the pyramid is made of rose quartz granite, which is a piezoelectric material, meaning it can produce electricity naturally under stress. And one of the forms of stress where it produces electricity is vibrational stress or acoustical stress. And then you have the entire pyramid made out of limestone, which is a natural acoustic amplifier, so good that the Greeks used it to build their amphitheaters because you could hear from the back. You know, if the stone seats were made of limestone, the voice would carry all the way to the back. So you've got this literal geo-energetic coupling between the stones. The limestone produces amplified acoustics, the rose quartz granite becomes electrical under acoustic pressure, and then we also find out that the King's Chamber, which is made of rose quartz granite, is specifically acoustically tuned. So why would they need to employ essentially high-level archaeoacoustics into their design for a tomb? It makes no sense. It's cheap to get on the plateau, and you can just spend the whole day there walking around looking at little, you know, tunnel ways going underground. And obviously you've got the pyramids and the Sphinx, but if you just look at the other temples and the other rocks, and you see evidence everywhere. Everywhere for high-grade machining tool marks and, like, you know, just cut direct lines through the rock. And one of the places in the, I think it was Cairo Museum, there's like a massive block of granite, like this, I mean, literally about the size of this table going all the way down, solid block. And it's kind of pushed into the corner of the museum room. So it's like basically in that corner, and it just looks like a big granite block. But if you squeeze yourself, and you literally have to squeeze yourself round against the wall to look on this side, and when you look on this side, there is a butter knife line just going directly through this piece of granite. Like, it literally just looks like someone took a laser and went zhoop. It's like, how do you explain that? And it's tucked into that corner. There are so many anomalies in Egypt, man. Like, literally, you could spend 3-4 hours just listing all the different artifacts, like the jugs and all these weird things that pop up that just completely contradict how advanced they were. It's amazing. Not just acoustic knowledge in terms of, like, oh, we can create a flute, but, like, we can build a stone building project that encodes specific amplifications of specific resonances. Now, that is high-level advanced acoustic knowledge that really we're only just beginning to understand ourselves in relation to looking at these sites and going, wow, okay, that they were encoding this harmonic science into it. So there's definitely something to say about sound, and we already know that we can levitate objects through sound bombardment at, like, ultrasonic levels. Our technology is quite fledgling in that regard, you know, like tiny little pieces of plastic that we can make hover above an ultrasonic emitter. So it's difficult to say with certainty, like, oh yeah, they were using advanced levitation of stone through sound technology that was, like, dampening the mass of the object through specific acoustic resonation. It's like, okay, well, that's really awesome. I'd love for it to be that. I don't know if it is that, but it's certainly not log rollers and ramps and, like, you know, 5,000 slaves that weren't educated in high mathematics and engineering. Like, this whole thing is so perfectly done that the idea of invoking a massive, relatively uneducated labor force is nonsensical, and you don't see the evidence of that. There's no evidence of ramps. You know, so the standard explanations don't really make sense. And there's so many other instances of huge stone weights being lifted at times where they shouldn't have been. The Baalbek temple in Lebanon, the Trilithon stones, which one of them weighs like 800 tons. And we attribute that to the ancient Romans, who apparently built that because they built a temple above this foundation called the Temple of Jupiter. And we attribute the entire thing to them, except that the highest lift in ancient Rome was like 450 tons. This is almost double the weight, and we attribute it to the ancient Romans. So it just, again, goes to show that we don't really understand how so many of these sites around the world got created. Stonehenge is another example. You know, how did they do that? And they all seem to encode this acoustic knowledge. So without being definitive, I find it very interesting, this idea that there's a lost technology of sound and acoustics, that when you're using the right geometries, when you're coupling it with the right harmonies, and when you're using the right materials, geoenergetic materials that are activated through sound or can produce electricity through vibrational stress, you know, you're getting to a point where it does feel like a lost science, and we're only really understanding that science through our own scientific mediums and realizing that they're a lot more advanced than we previously believed with the acoustic knowledge. So realms outside of the normal default level of perception that I think, you know, we have not explored, we have not understood, And there is a lot of mystery and there is a lot of insight to be gathered and gained from these novel states of consciousness that I think these people were cultivating. Again, you look at the acoustic sciences and they seem to be geared towards activation of brainwave frequencies, activation of theta and meditative states of brainwave function. And so maybe this is the interface. So they were constructing these temples because of the shamanic states that they've been engaging in for hundreds and thousands of years. And one of the things that you see when you're on psychedelics is geometries, right? You get this incredible sense of geometry and precision and mathematics. And that could be the beginnings of then going, right, well, we're going to bring these geometries down into the physical world. Suddenly you get Stonehenge and these incredible designs that are completely geometrically perfect and mathematical and aligned to all these natural energies. Solon, who was a sacred sage of Greece, ancient Greece, and a lawmaker, very respected individual. And he traveled to the city of Sais in ancient Egypt and spoke with the priests there. That was where he got the story of Atlantis. The priests of Egypt essentially laughed at him and said, oh, you know, you don't know anything about history. You Greek, you Hellenes, Solon, you don't know. There has been many rises and falls of civilization before your time, before our time. And that's where they gave him the story of Atlantis. So they originally gave it to Solon, you know, returns to Greece and gives his story on until it reaches Plato. His two books, he mentions Atlantis, and he's very specific. He gives the measurements of like the area and stadia, which is the measurements of Greece at the time. He describes them between the two twin pillars of Hercules, which some people attribute to Gibraltar, potentially. But there's been a lot of sites that people have put down, like the Eye of the Sahara, the Rickart structure. That's another one that's circulated in terms of a potential location for it. I think it was real. I think Atlantis, maybe as an idea, was real. Maybe not specifically a city called Atlantis, but a culture or civilization that eventually got referenced as Atlantis. Again, it just falls back into this lost time period just before the Younger Dryas Cataclysm, just after the glacial maximum. There was a very critical window, a very interesting period of time. Just after that kind of glacial maximum was starting to melt down and before the Younger Dryas kicked in, you had several thousand years of relative climate stability, especially in certain pockets like Egypt and other areas. So it's interesting that there was this critical development window that we ignore. We ignore that. You know, you think about the fact that we've gone from horse and cart to superconductor in 150 years. That's nothing. So there's potential for several thousand years worth of development before the Younger Dryas Cataclysm. It's very likely that something could have been happening at that time, you know, an advanced civilization. Self-healing Roman concrete, this stuff is incredible. They only recently, I think in 2023 at MIT, managed to recreate this concrete. But even then they had to use like synthetic variants. They had no idea how to truly make the recipe for this concrete that gets harder over time. And when cracks appear in it and water enters the crack, it calcifies and turns into more concrete. Mm-hmm. So it's like nanoparticle self-healing concrete, right? There are like these weird anomalous advancements in ancient Roman Greece that would suggest ancient knowledge that they were having access to, maybe from Sumeria or Mesopotamia. And even the Sumerian and Mesopotamian history seems to reference older knowledge coming from a more ancient past. So my question is, why do things keep getting more advanced the further we go back into time? That's contradictory, right? It shouldn't get more advanced stonework, more advanced technology. And yet that's what we see. I think the Younger Dryas and like the Meltwater Pulse 1B do explain, again, over 200 cultures have this global flood myth. A lot of those cultures will attribute a more advanced civilization prior to that flood. And the anomalies that we pick up across the world that do not match with the known capabilities of the time period we attribute it to is all evidence that there is an anomalous chapter that just has not been uncovered properly yet. And, you know, one of the frustrating things, again, from mainstream history is like, you know, well, where is all the evidence? Where is all the evidence of advanced knowledge and advanced technology? I don't even understand that question anymore. It's literally everywhere, my man. Like, you know, go to Egypt and look at the machining tools. Go to Peru and look at the Cyclopean stone walls of Sacsayhuaman, which are multi-ton and fit together like jigsaw pieces and look like they've been melted into place. Like, and the artifacts, the fact that you've got these incredible Phoenician jugs that are perfectly balanced and mathematically balanced to the point where you would actually need a modern computationally driven machining technology to achieve that level of balance. And then you have that right next to like really bad, uneven pottery, which makes sense for the time period. So what are these anomalies? Where do they come from? There's a really interesting cup. I think it's pronounced the Lycurgus cup. It's L-Y... LYRCGUS or something like that. It's in the British Museum, and it's this incredible cup. I think it's 4th century, and it's Roman, but it's actually got nanoparticle gold and silver alloys embedded into it in a specific sequence that allows for a type of surface plasmonic resonance, right? This is literally true, that changes its color from green to red when the light bounces off of it and reflects. And basically the effect, this incredible like red to green shifting that looks so magical when you see this cup, it's this incredibly crafted goblet with this glass. The effect is only possible because of these like 50 nanometer gold and silver particulates that are embedded into the glass. So that's literally
what's the name of this again?
Lycurgus, L-Y-R-C-G-U-S, something like that. Mm-hmm. The Lycurgus cup in the British Museum.
Okay.
And it literally by definition is nanotechnology. By definition, because it's using, in a particularly distributed manner, nanoparticles of materials to produce an effect. So that's nanotech. 2,000 years before it was supposed to happen. So... but again, you don't see these cups everywhere. So it's an anomaly. So where did the anomaly come? Where did that knowledge come from? And I think that we have to accept the fact that especially in Rome and Egypt and Greece, they had civilized hierarchical structures of governance and scholarly academia to the point where they could have secrets, special access programs, whatever you might want to call them, what we would call today classified research. Who's to say that some of these scholars didn't have access to Babylonian schematics and were like, right, we'll figure this out. And then lo and behold, you get the Antikythera mechanism or the Lycurgus cup or all these anomalies that are not distributed en masse throughout these cultures, but exist. So the fact that they exist, like, literally means that there has to have been other tools, there has to have been other systems and methods that are more advanced than what we attribute. You know, the existence of these anomalies demands that, and modern historians ignore it. Again, they're very easy and they're very quick to do incredible work on the things that they can explain, right? So if they can explain it, they'll do all of that brilliant work. When they can't explain it, they just seem to ignore it.
What is under the Giza Plateau? That is the question that so many of us right now are asking in light of the recent revelations from the Khafre Pyramid Project team, who have been studying and scanning the Giza Pyramid Complex and specifically the Khafre Pyramid for over a year, leveraging groundbreaking methodologies in synthetic aperture radar and Doppler techniques, through which they've produced incredible scans that indicate massive 630-meter structures coming down from the base of the Khafre Pyramid deep into the bedrock. Joining me now is George Howard, founder and organizer of the Cosmic Summit Conference, the world's number one heterodox history gathering, where the Khafre Pyramid team will be joining myself and a number of incredible speakers next month in North Carolina. I can't wait to be involved to speak with the research team behind these studies in more depth. So, George, can you tell people about the Cosmic Summit? When is this going down? Who's going to be speaking? And how can people get involved?
Thanks, Jay. Great to be on your channel. Cosmic Summit begins on the solstice, Friday, June 20th. But it runs through the 23rd. We have 2 full days of speakers, 27 of them, on Saturday and Sunday. And then on Monday, we have a separate ticket that's a deep dive, where there's 6 different classrooms, we call them, where you'll spend 3 hours with the speakers to, you know, give you the real lowdown. So when you come out of the room, they know you, you know them, kind of stuff, right? And that includes everybody from Randall Carlson to Scott Walter to Ben Van Kirkwick, all have classrooms. The main thing that we have for your audience, and I know you and I share this interest intensely, is the first public appearance of the Italian researchers, Filippo Biondi and Armando May, who stunned the world in March, revealing a new technology that could examine beneath the pyramids. And this is going to be their first public presentation since, and their first appearance in the United States. And we're going to have a press conference. Hopefully we can get some people interested that were, you know, it was splashed all over the headlines before. We hope to have people come and follow up and ask them some questions. The whole thing about the pyramid scan, I think the first reaction was, I want to know more. I think that's universally shared. Well, we have more in Greensboro. On June 21st, Saturday, at 1:30 p.m., the Italian pyramid scan researchers are going to give another reveal. We got a big show this year. We got a premiere of an Atlantis documentary coming Saturday night at 9 p.m., and that's called Atlantica, and the producer, Michael Donnellan, and also the star of the movie. I've watched it. It's a docuseries, and it has an absolutely astounding conclusion, and I am sworn to secrecy about it. Hands-on with the pre-dynastic Egyptian vases that fascinates everyone. They are actually going to be physically available to us. Compliments of Matt Bell of the Limitless Podcast. And Matt will be bringing a portion of his collection. I do not know how large, but I do suspect it'll be the largest public display of such objects since Amenhotep stuffed them in the basement of Saqqara. There are not many opportunities to go see more than a handful of these, and they're going to be in Greensboro. Hugh Newman's going to do an immersive kind of 3D experience room at Karahantepe and other interesting places he has explored around the world.
An incredible lineup of people, some of which I am really excited to speak to myself. Very excited to see the team behind these studies present their findings outside of the Italian conferences. Like you said, this is the first time in the United States. It's going to be a very special event. And the team behind these Giza studies are far from being done. There is so much more to get into. Will people have the opportunity to speak to some of these people themselves, some of the scientists?
Randall Carlson and the rest of these guys are your buddies over that weekend, right? It is a hangout with the gang conference. It's not a fly-in, fly-out kind of thing. And we wouldn't put up over it. Nobody's that big a deal yet, right? Well, maybe Randall, but he's a good guy, so he doesn't need to fly in, fly out. No, you meet them all. And, you know, it's a pretty well-lubricated conference. And we've got 10 cases of vodka left over from last year. And we'll have bars at all the events. So it really is, you know, as we say, a chance to sit down and have a beer with Robert Schock.
Now, it's not easy for everyone to get to some of these places physically. So is there a way for people to watch from the comfort of their own home?
They sure can. And we're calling it the virtual pass because the term live stream turns me off. It sounds like something you could miss, right? You can't miss this. You can watch it that weekend. You can watch it live. You can watch it a month later or your entire life, right? So you're going to get the entire conference, all 27 speakers, are available through the virtual pass. We're going to have three cameras, if you think of it this way. One camera is going to be showing who is speaking, right? And if there are two breakouts, there'll actually be two. Okay, but then we're going to have two other cameras, and one is going to be what we're calling the Cosmic News Desk, right? Where we're going to sit down and have kind of one of those kind of live, informal desks where people are coming in and out, not really programmed, where we take them back and ask them some questions. Wild, you can do this now, but there is going to be somebody, and we're going to hand the glasses around. Maybe you'll carry them for a while. I certainly look forward to it. And just go around in the glasses, talk to the audience, talk to the speakers, you know, kind of give you the experience of being there. But the cool thing is, a lot of these conferences, both business and, you know, spiritual and alternative history and whatnot, someone will charge $300 and $400 and have seven speakers. I don't know how they get away with it, right? But we're charging list price $75, and that gives you all 27 speakers, both cams, opportunity to ask questions, interact, and text, and we'll be following that at the news desk. But if you use this promo code, 3CAMS is what we named it. The number three, CAMS, right? 3CAMS, when you go and buy the virtual ticket, it'll take it from $75 to $50.
So, George, what do you think is under the Giza Plateau?
I know there's something under there because I went down the Osiris shaft and it scared the shit out of me.
I've seen enough images. I haven't been down it personally yet, but it's on my to-do list.
I had done some up close and personal down. They didn't find that place till the 80s. And you think there's just one little shaft that they dug over there two-thirds of the way down the causeway or wherever in the hell it is, kind of off to the side, and they just happened to build that and put a, you know, 45-ton black diorite box down in it, and that's probably it down there. Well, first of all, when you get to the bottom and you look back, you can just see that it goes on and on when you hit the water level. So a little bit of personal experience. It's like, okay, I know that. And then you walk around the plateau and there's this gate and that locked door. And just like Trevor Grassi, our mutual friend, is so well documented. I mean, it ain't a few. It's hundreds of access points. So we know it's riddled with some kind of subterranean activity. How extensive it is, we don't know. But that's a fucking fact. Okay, it's riddled with it. Okay. Then you say, okay, if these people did dig around, we've just established that. They did another thing, obviously, too. They built this, you know, 2.3 million block structure above. What would they seek to accomplish underground? And if they sought to accomplish something underground, how accomplished might they be? I think they'd pull something pretty damn incredible off underground. My sense says that there's something more down there. Then we lay on our friends Filippo Armando and Corrado Malanga, you know, who've revealed this technology. And I think we're of the same mind. Technology progresses, first of all. We've had one of the most outstanding progressions in the last 2 years any of us have ever experienced since the internet came out, and that's AI. And AI is going to assist other technologies, and it's going to bring things forth, particularly large, complex data sets. And though I can't truth Filippo Biondi's complex math in the 22 paper or any of the subsequent stuff or his previous 85 publications, very dense technical stuff, I can't proof that. Okay, but I don't think he's been wasting 30 years. I believe the U.S. government surely got similar technology, whether they got to it the same place or not, who knows, but we know exactly what is under that nuclear mountain in Iran. That's been a question, the biggest geopolitical strategic question, hidden thing question. Same thing in North Korea, right? And if you don't think a couple of thousand people are using a technology right now in the U.S. government that's more sophisticated than just synthetic aperture radar, then you have very little confidence.
Well, I think also there was just a lot of misrepresentation from people that you assume are very methodical in the mainstream academic sector. And, you know, there were some pretty blatant assumptions being made.
An incredible thing to claim has caused a massive response from both the alternative research community and the mainstream sectors.
I would love this kind of stuff to be true, but it is total bullshit. They're using a method that has never been presented before in depth. It's never been tested. It follows all the rules of pseudoscience.
When they've tested it on the Gran Sasso laboratory in Italy, and they tested this technology on the Mosul Dam in Iraq, and Filippo Biondi, the guy that actually proposed this whole Doppler synthetic aperture radar fusion, has done it on structural integrity for bridges. So the actual proof of concept was there, but there was a lot of reflexive, I think, knee-jerk reaction from the mainstream that they hadn't even done the due diligence on people like Filippo Biondi before tarnishing him as a pseudoscientist. And I think that was a big mistake, because the receipts, like you said, 85 papers, the man is an established academic in Italy and very much has the proof of concept with these types of synthetic aperture radar and Doppler integration. It's so exciting that we're going to have the opportunity to actually speak to and hear from these people all in one place. And so I am just so looking forward to discussing all of this and more with you, the CAFRA Pyramid team, and everyone else who's taking part in this incredible gathering to discuss the implications of human history, which is a subject of utmost importance. And hopefully we will see some of you in North Carolina at this event. And links to purchase tickets are in the description box below, so check that out. If you can't make it in person, you can still grab a virtual ticket and watch the conference unfold from the comfort of your home, with live streams and multiple cameras giving you a first-person perspective as if you were there yourself. So join us on June 20th to the 23rd as we challenge the historical narrative over at the Cosmic Summit.